You are listening to Gangland Wire, hosted by former Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit Detective Gary Jenkins.
Welcome, all you wiretappers out there. Let's go back and take a look at Carmine Galante and see how he ended up on the floor of Joe and Mary's Italian-American restaurant in Lower Manhattan. He was born, like most of these guys, in 1910 in a tenement building in East Harlem section of Manhattan. His parents were, of course, Italian immigrants from Sicily, from Castellammare del Golfo, Sicily. His dad had been a fisherman. When he was in grade school, Carmine Galante gave up his real given name, Carmelo, and insisted he be called Carmine instead. He had a couple of brothers, Samuel and Peter Galante, two sisters. He got married pretty early in life to Helen Murillo. He had three children, James, Camilla, and Angela Galante. But for the last 20 years of his life, he lived with another woman, Ann Acquavilla. They had two children together. One of his nephews became a capo in the Bonanno crime family. So Carmine the Cigar Galante was a real La Cosa Nostra mobster. He had the history, he had the family connections, and he had the personality. Carmine Galante was not very big. He stood 5.5 feet tall and only weighed about 160 pounds. You know, when he was in prison one time in the 1930s, he was diagnosed as having a psychopathic personality and a really low IQ. This goes to show you native intelligence and a vicious temperament will take you a long ways in the criminal world. By the age of 10, like many of these guys, they were sent to reform school for their criminal activities. He joined up with a juvenile street gang on New York's Lower East Side. Attended public school. He was adjudged an incorrigible delinquent before he got out of high school. As a teenager during Prohibition, Carmine Galante got his start in the mafia. He worked as a fish sorter and at an artificial flower shop, supposedly, but that was really just a ruse. He actually, from day one, practically, in his teenage years, he was a full-time professional criminal. 1925, he was 15 years old, he pled guilty to his first major crime. It was an assault. He got 2.5 years in state prison in 1926. Right after that, that seems pretty young. He'd only been 16 to get 2.5 years in state prison. He was released from penitentiary in 1930. He got another sham job at O'Brien Fish Market near the Fulton Fish Market in Lower Manhattan. He had quite a career during the 1930s. Besides working with the bootleggers, he was doing robberies. Carmine Galante, along with a guy named Michael Consolo and Angelo Presenzano, were arrested and indicted for the murder of a New York police officer, another Italian, by the way, Walter Di Castilla, during a payroll robbery. They beat that case and were released because of a lack of evidence. More than likely, somebody got paid off. Later in 1930, a New York City police officer, Joseph Meehan, caught Galante and other gang members trying to hijack a truck in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Had a gun battle, and Galante wounded Meehan and another six-year-old kid. Both of them survived. He was arrested, pled guilty to the robbery, and he got 12.5 years in state prison. That was on February the 8th, 1931. By 1939, he was released from prison again. And that's when they did some testing on him, and he supposedly had an IQ of only a 90. They equated his mental age to that of a person 14 years old. The doctor who carried out that examination said that Galante was shy, had no knowledge of current events or any items of common knowledge. He was also showing early signs of gonorrhea. Not a very good start, but, you know, this guy went on to be one of the more powerful mobsters in New York City in the Five Families. By 1940, during the war, he was carrying out hits for Vito Genovese, the official underboss of the Luciano crime crew. Lucky Luciano was deported to Sicily during this time. He actually became a made member of the Bonanno crime family under Joe Bananas or Joe Bonanno. That was sometime before the end of the war. He was suspected over his lifetime to be involved in over 80 murders. During the war, he had a kind of a no-show job as a stevedore, a member of the local 856 of the Longshoremen's Union. 1943, he supposedly murdered Carlo Tresca, the publisher of an anti-fascist newspaper. Genovese, who had been living in Italy at this point in time, offered to kill Tresca as a favor to Mussolini in order to have Mussolini's protection during the war. And I guess he hoped probably after the war even. Gave that contract to Galente. No one was ever charged in that murder. After the Tresca murder, he was sent back. Galente was sent back to prison on a parole violation. At the end of the, about the end of the war, December 1944, for the war was pretty much all but over, and Galente was released from prison. When Carmine Galente got out, he became a chauffeur for the Bonanno family crime boss, Joe Bonanas, or Joe Bonanno. He was the underboss at that point in time. Carmine Galente, his whole life would be loyal to Joe Bonanno and always spoke of him with great admiration. They shared a common enemy, Carlo Gambino of the Anastasia crime family. Galente was a willing participant in Bonanno's big plan to expand his crime family's interests south to Florida and the West Coast and the Caribbean and north into Canada. During that time, Galente won a reputation with the other mobsters of being as greedy as Joe Bonanas. Now, that's pretty greedy, I understand. 1953, this is when the heroin distribution program started. 1953, Joe Bonanno sent Carmine Galente to Montreal, Quebec, to supervise the family drug business. Joe Bonanno, out of the 30s and 40s, that crime family had gotten into importing heroin from the Mideast, you know, the French Connection, through Marseille, using the Corsica Mafia, to Montreal, and then down through New York and throughout the rest of the United States. They pretty well controlled it all, except for the West Coast, where some was coming in from China, China White. But primarily, it was Turkish brown heroin that came in over the next 20 years or so. Galente got close with the mafia crime family in Montreal. At that point in time was a man named Vic Controni. By 1957, Carmine Galente had come to the attention of the Canadian government, and they deported him back to the United States. 1955, he actually became the underboss to the Bonanno crime family. 1957, again, Bonanno and Carmine Galente attended a meeting in Palermo, Sicily, to set up a heroin distribution formally into the United States. Attendees of that meeting were still in exile, Lucky Luciano and some other American mobsters, a Sicilian mafia delegation led by mobster Giuseppe Genco Russo. As part of that agreement, Sicilian mobsters would come to the United States to help distribute the narcotics, and they were unknown over here. They became known as Zips. Galente was responsible for bringing many, many young Italian, Sicilian men over during these next few years. Awful lot of them from his family hometown of Castellammare del Golfo. About a year later, in 1959, New Jersey State Police happened to stumble across him driving a car on the Garden State Parkway, stopped him and arrested him. Actually, I think he was probably, more than likely, he was set up. I don't think they just stumbled into him. I was just kidding you on that. You know that I just didn't stumble onto that. Federal agents had recently discovered that Galente was hiding in a house on Pelican Island down on the Jersey Shore, so they had set up a surveillance and caught him coming and just called in the uniform troopers to stop him. I've done that a jillion times myself. He had to post a $100,000 bail. And then was indicted on a second set of narcotics charges in 1960. His first trial started in 1960 on these distribution of heroin charges, which is a big deal in 1960. That's when the government really started cracking down, and heroin became what the government believed was a big problem. You know, early days of the war on drugs, shall we say. In that first trial, jurors and alternate jurors kept dropping out, and there were coercive courtroom displays by the defendants. If you think about it, they packed that courtroom with the hard-eyed, tough guys who glare at everybody. Maybe if they've got some turncoat in there, if you remember in The Godfather, you know, that's all stuff is all ripped from real life. They just bring a relative of his in and have him stare the guy down. This trial was not without any dramatics. One of his hitmen, Anthony Mira, became so unhinged that he picked up a chair and threw it to the prosecutor. The chair missed the prosecutor and landed in the jury's box, forcing all the jurors to scatter in all directions. You imagine sitting on that jury, having a crazy man like that. Nothing scares this guy. The government, the weight of the entire United States government coming down on him, and he's still not scared, and he'll still fight back and strike out. I would not want to sit on that jury. Later in 1961, the judge declared a mistrial. The jury foreman had fallen down some stairs in his house and was unable to continue the trial due to his injury. Now, I'm suspicious about that one, too. Galante did get 20 days in jail for contempt of court during this trial. Then he had a second narcotics trial, and he was actually sentenced on that when he got 20 years in the federal prison. He was sent some of his time. He was sent to the highest security level prisons. He spent some of his time in Alcatraz, probably some in Atlanta, too. That was a high security prison back then. That's where Joe Valachi ended up turning. Around that time, I'll have to look that up on Joe Valachi. They said that even in prison, Galante was the big duck. He was the big man. Everybody knew that he was the big man. You did not cross Carmine Galante. Said on one occasion, there's a whole line of inmates gathered up waiting in line to have their weekly phone call. They only got one phone call a week, and they had to line up for the few phones that there were there. Galante entered the room, walked over the phone. There's a black inmate standing there, and he said simply, "Give me the phone, nigger." Without hesitation or retaliation by anybody else, he got it. I don't think he could get away with that today. But back in those days, a guy like Carmine Galante could get away with it. He must have had some really, like, personally powerful charisma anywhere he went to swing with that kind of weight, even in the penitentiary or out of the penitentiary. I mean, he's a guy that's operating with a lot of other tough guys, so he must have had some kind of a personal charisma that just exuded, you know, that you want this guy, you want his approval, you want to do what he says, and you do not want to cross him. Now, you don't get that just by myth. You got to have that personal kind of power just emanating from yourself. And actually, to the other New York crime families, when Galante was sent to jail, they were kind of relieved because he was perceived as such a strong boss. During this time in the 1960s, Joe Bonanno started plotting to eliminate most of the other leaders of the rival families, which resulted in what became known as the Bonanno War and ended up ruining Joe Bonanno. And he had intended on taking over all the families and installing his son as a successor of, like, the boss of all bosses, the Capo de Tutti de Capi and that kind of stuff. Galante was plotting his strategy from behind bars. He didn't feel like anybody out there was his equal. He felt like he was the boss of all bosses, and he wanted to accomplish what Joe Bonanno was unable to do. He actually made this claim while he was in the federal penitentiary at Lewisburg. He said, "I'll make Carlo Gambino shit in the middle of Times Square." Some people claim that he says, "I'll make Carlo Gambino suck my dick in the middle of Times Square." But more than likely, he said, "Make him shit in the middle of Times Square." 1964, Joe Bonanno and his quest to become the boss of all bosses allied with a guy named Joseph Magliocco, who was in the Profaci Colombo crime family. They plotted to murder three other members of the Mafia Commission. When the plot was discovered, the commission got together and ordered Bonanno to retire. He tried to install his son Salvatore Bonanno as the boss, but the commission took his family away from him, and they put in a series of ineffectual bosses. While in prison, Carmine Galante made it known to everybody that when he got out, he was taking control of the New York Mafia by the throat. 1974, he was released from prison on parole. A few days after he was released, he allegedly ordered the bombing. Now, this is crazy. He ordered the bombing of the doors to the mausoleum of someone he considered had been a longtime enemy of his rise in the mob, and that was Frank Costello, who, you know, Frank Costello, the prime minister of the underworld, he did not believe in mob wars. He didn't believe in going around killing each other. He believed in being quiet and quietly making money. Frank Costello was already dead, of course. This was his mausoleum. I'm not sure what was in Galante's mind other than he was announcing to all the other crime families that he was back and he was going to do something. But at this point in time in 1974, the commission had designated a man named Philip Rastelli to be the official boss of the old Bonanno crime family. And he wasn't really that hip and wasn't that dangerous. And he got sent to prison, and Carmine Galante then seized control of the Bonanno crime family. He had always considered that he was the rightful successor to Joe Bonanno since he had been his underboss at one time, even though he'd spent the last 10 years or so in the penitentiary. He started a mob war. He organized the murders of at least 8 members of the Gambino crime family. During the 1970s, he wanted to take over all drug trafficking operations. He surrounded himself with Sicilian-born mafioso. Some of their names, I don't really know these people. Cesare Bonaventure, Salvatore Catalano, and Baldassare Amato. In 1978, United States Parole Commission revoked Carmine Galante's parole. He was sent back to the penitentiary. Everybody on the, if you weren't part of Galante's little plot to take over all the crime families, when he got sent back to the penitentiary, they were quietly and privately relieved because they knew he wanted to push everybody else in the background and take over. From prison, he supposedly sent out a message to all the other New York crime bosses, "Who among you is going to stand up against me?" In 1979, much to the disappointment of the other 5 family bosses, a judge ruled that the government had illegally revoked Galante's parole and ordered his immediate release from prison. By this point in his life, Galante was getting older, kind of stooped, and he was bald, bespeckled. But he still envisioned himself as the boss of all bosses. It was only a matter of time before he brought all the other bosses of the 5 families, or before families, actually outside the Bonanno family, to heel, and they made him the boss of all bosses. All the other crime families were pretty much alarmed at his brazen attempt at taking over the entire narcotics market. Galante refused to share any drug profits with the other families. He knew he had a lot of enemies, and he also once said, "No one will ever kill me. They wouldn't dare." He swaggered around the streets of New York. The other mob bosses went to Florida. They couldn't even do this in New York. They went to Florida to Boca Raton and held a meeting deciding what they were going to do with this guy. At this meeting were Funzie Tierra, Geraldo Catena, Paul Castellano, and Florida boss Santo Traficante Jr. These men voted unanimously that if there was ever going to be mob peace in the streets of New York, Galante had to go. It just caused too much heat. Even the aged Bonanno, Joe Bonanno, retired out in Florida, was asked if he had any reservations about his former close associate being hit. And Bonanno signed off. Bonanno himself signed off on Galante's murder contract. His days were numbered. July 12, 1979, Carmine Galante sitting in Joe and Mary's Italian-American restaurant at 205 Knickerbocker Avenue in Bushwick, Brooklyn. He was eating with Leonard Coppola, an old Bonanno capo, a restaurant owner, and one of his cousins, Giuseppe Tirano, and another Bonanno soldier. He also was sitting with his Sicilian bodyguards, Baldassare Amato and Cesare Bomentre, at 1445 or 2:45 in the afternoon. I lapsed back into police lingo there for a minute. At 2:45 in the afternoon, July 12th, 1979, 3 ski-masked men entered the restaurant, walked directly into the patio in the back, and opened fire with shotguns and handguns. Galante, Tirano, and Coppola were killed instantly. And you've all seen that picture. Some enterprising New York Times photographer or some independent photographer got to the scene right away, got up above this patio and shot straight down on the Carmine Galante, laying there dead underneath his table with his cigar still clamped in his mouth. It was a fitting end. Armato and Bonaventure had done nothing to protect Galante because actually they were in on the hit and they ran out of the restaurant themselves. The three men who actually pulled the triggers were Anthony Indelicato, Dominic Trinchera, and Dominic Napolitano. And then the fourth man would help them, Louis Giangetti. This hit became an instant media sensation. It was not a New York Times, it was a New York Daily News reporter who grabbed that story and grabbed that picture. Police wouldn't let him in the restaurant, so he climbed on top of a building rooftop back behind it and was able to grab that picture. I mean, what the heck? He's quoted as saying, "How odd, I thought. He still had the damn cigar in his mouth. He was looking up at the sky, one eye blown away and flies covering his face. Not even Hollywood could think of a better ending for such a man as Carmine Galante." The Archdiocese of New York refused to allow a funeral mass for Galante. We had a little bit of that problem here in Kansas City when Nick Civella died. Although they couldn't find a priest, the church was going to allow him to be buried in the Sacred Heart Church down in Columbus Park area and Little Italy area. But where his all of his family, all of my bosses in Kansas City had a funeral mass said there. They didn't prevent that, but they had a hard time getting a priest. They finally had to found a priest that would do the service. He was laid out in the Provenzano Lanza Funeral Home down in 43 Second Avenue on the Lower East Side. I mean, this is old school mob stuff here. But the crowd that usually accompanies and attends a mafia wake of a boss like this was notably absent. He had left all his friends behind except the few people that are right around him close and were making money off of him, and even his bodyguards left at the end. He's buried in St. John's Cemetery in Queens. Feds counted only 59 people at his funeral mass and burial. There was not one made man in the funeral, according to the FBI. One FBI agent supposedly commented, "Galante was so bad, people didn't really want to see him even after he was dead." One of his bodyguards in 1984 was found murdered in a New Jersey warehouse. Supposedly to guarantee his silence, he must have been putting some pressure on him to talk about that murder. One of the murders in 1987, one of the trigger men on this murder, Anthony Indelicato, was sentenced to 40 years in prison as a member of the commission trial. He was in prison, actually, for the Galante, Coppola, and Toronto murders. Although never mentioned by name, Galante is referenced twice in the movie Donnie Brasco. He's just mentioned as a cigar-smoking character known as the boss, and then later in the movie, the person playing mobster Benjamin Ruggiero points to a story in a newspaper and says, "Can you believe it? The fucking boss gets whacked." You know, another reference in popular culture to the killing of Carmine Galante was in The Sopranos. If you remember, Tony Soprano was playing golf with his neighbor, Dr. Cusimano. And Cusimano, he kind of like is trying to play a part in somebody. You know, anytime if you're Italian, then people want to think that you're connected to the mafia, and even though you're not. And sometimes people will then act like, you know, "I know a guy, you know, I got something that fell off a truck. I can get somebody to take care of that for you." So somebody in the golf foursome asked Cusimano if he ever saw the picture of Galante dead with a cigar hanging in his mouth. And Cusimano describes the murder as a fucking beautiful hit, like he knew anything about a hit or anything. But just like that's a pretty normal thing that shall we say, civilians do. Anyhow, that's kind of a thumbnail sketch of Carmine the Cigar Galante. I remember when this hit happened, a friend of my son's family was all living in New Jersey, and they knew a lot. Anytime you live in New Jersey, just across from Manhattan, you pay attention to all this stuff. And one of them had gotten that paper, the New York Daily Post, that had the picture in it. And Eddie had gotten hold of that picture and cut it out and sent it to Scott, and who gave it to me. And I used to have it framed on my office wall when I was in the intelligence unit, just to imagine what I ever do with it. I think I had left that down at Aaron's studio. I think he's got it on the wall down there. Sometimes as I've gotten older, I don't really see quite the glamour in that. When I was a young intelligence unit copper, I saw the glamour, and it made me seem like I was probably tougher and more powerful than what I really was if I could brush up against people like this. But anyhow, I digress. It's a heck of a story. And this guy, he was a bad dude. He was one bad dude. And, you know, the war on drugs eventually took him out. Only it wasn't the cops that took him out or the FBI that took him out. It was his refusal to share the profits in heroin. That's so much for the government's war on drugs. They war on each other over the profits. If you look at what's his name, El Chapo just got convicted, but there's already people lined up behind him, and it's still flowing into the country, and it's like whack-a-mole. You know, you knock it out in New York, it moves to Cuba. You knock it out in Cuba, and it moves to New Orleans, and that's back in the 30s and 40s and 50s. And it starts coming in from Colombia, and you knock it out coming up via Florida, and then it comes up via California, and then it comes up in Laredo and El Paso, Juarez, and all across the border down there. And then you whack it out all across the border. Trump wants to put a wall up and stop all the drugs. Then they just tunnel underneath. I saw a deal where they were using drones to bring them across. Or then maybe you just put it on these little submarine things that they were making and come up this coast of California and just come on up above L.A. and come on up farther north to Santa Barbara and on up in there and land up there and bring it in that way. It's impossible to stop. Or maybe you start using those submarines to bring them up from down in the Bahamas. You get it to the Bahamas easy enough, and then you bring it up and land it on the coast of North Carolina or South Carolina along in there. And then maybe you go back to airplanes and you land in Arkansas like they did for a while. So it's I knew a guy once. Here's another one. I knew a guy once that told me he was working out in western Kansas. And he was staying in this old hotel that had been converted to apartments in a kind of a middle-sized town. He'd go up on the roof sometimes just to smoke cigarettes and drink beer and just sit in the sun. And he heard a plane flying kind of low, and he watched it as it dipped down pretty low over a Kansas field. And all of a sudden, bales started, some kind of, I say bales, he didn't know what it was, some kind of object started tumbling out of this airplane, you know, like 25 or 30 of them. And he's going, what the heck? And he's down at the bar later on, and he's gotten to know one local by then, and he says, hey, he said, I saw this. He said, what's the deal? He said, oh, he said, that's those marijuana smugglers. They make a run up and drop those off, and some guys come out and pick up and grab that up and disappear with it. So it's impossible to stop, and because there's so much money to be made and so much power to be garnered from having a big drug organization. And so, you know, it's eliminate the demand. If you have a friend or relative with problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. This way, you can have your part in the war on drugs in a more skillful and probably effective manner. Stop the demand. Thank you to all you wiretappers out there for supporting me. Don't forget about my Venmo app. You can buy me a cup of coffee for a buck or two. You can go to my Gangland Wire Facebook page or my Instagram or Twitter feed, like and share that stuff. Give me a review on iTunes. That always helps. Buy my Kansas City Mob Tour app. That's a pretty inexpensive way to help, and you'll get a whole bunch more content all about the Kansas City Mob. Thanks, folks.
Music provided by our good friend and super fan from Portland, Oregon, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey.